Oh, man. I'm going to have to read it in the middle.
Yeah, it works.
But,
good job. Can we hug before we start? Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming and spending some of your Friday afternoon with me. My name is Toppy, and I am a professor of classical studies at Boston College. You might know me from such Fox News articles as alpaca professor forces students to engage in furry lifestyle. Doing the Lord's work. At a Catholic college, which is fun. Let me just give you a little bit of background here. So I teach every 2 years a course called Beast Literature, which is about talking animals in ancient Mediterranean cultures, in medieval European reception, and then in modern cultures. What we're going to talk about today is bits and pieces of that kind of material, of other research that I do. When I teach about foxtails in my course, I have 16 weeks. For the fox stuff, even for one of the works, which is the story of Reynard the Fox, which is going to be a lot of what we talk about today, even for that, I've got a good 2.5 weeks to work with students. They've done prep ahead of time, that kind of thing. All of this is to say, this is not a comprehensive history of foxes in European literature from the beginning to the end. We're just going to kind of take tastes of things, and I want to show you some variety of what's going on. I want to tell you some interesting stories, introduce you to some interesting artists or some interesting writers that you might not know about, and to talk a little bit just like about what it is that, what do we do with foxes, right? We all love foxes. Raise your hand if you love foxes. Woo! That's right. You don't get out. The door's open. So it's going to be partial sort of selection of things as we go along. Feel free to ask questions. Feel free to ask questions at the end. Feel free to ask questions in the middle. And I'll try to get things as we go. So, real quick, a quick plug for another project that's part of the work that I do. So, besides teaching Greek and Latin and ancient Mediterranean cultures, increasingly my research, my work has to do with furry history and with furry culture and furry identity. I feel extremely blessed that I can make that my job, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to do. One of the things that's part of that is I co-direct a furry history and media archive project called Fang, Feather, and Fin with my friends Chipper Wolf and Gail Frostbane. Again, you might recognize them from such Fox News articles as coming to my class and perverting whatever, I don't know. We have a Twitter account, we have a newsletter on our website, fangfeatherandfin.com. I was so hoping to be able to say this today, but paperwork is what it is. Hopefully within the next week or so, we will be a 501(c) nonprofit. Subscribe, follow. We release new articles once every week or two. They're deep dives into the history of fursuits. Gail Frostbane does a really cool series called This Old Fursuit. Some of you might have seen Hilda the Bambioid recently, her article on that. I do dives into comics. Chipper has just done a really cool long article about the history of furry muck and online furry spaces in the 90s and 2000s. So it's really cool. So if you also besides just following, engaging, ask questions, let us know things that you're interested in. If you have any furry media that you would like to donate, that you'd like to rehome, we're delighted any time to give it a good home and to take care of it. The goal is to make as much of this publicly accessible as we possibly can within the limitations of copyright, which copyright, by the way, like every academic hates copyright issue. Like, not, I mean, it's important, right? But when it comes time, like, oh, you need image rights for publishing your book, and it's just like gouging your eyes to try to get that to work and try to get permissions correctly and blah, blah, we have made that a large chunk of our lives. So yay, copyright. If anybody has copyright suggestions, or if anybody owns copyright to works of furry media, if you would like to give it, not give copyright, but give us permissions to digitize, we'd be delighted. So come, you know, give us a holler anytime. Okay, let's jump into the material of, can everybody hear me in the back okay?
What?
Who? Okay. Cool, awesome. So teacher voice is working. A quick heads up, so this is a Safe for Work panel, but it's also a panel that will deal with some sort of complicated, difficult, sensitive topics. So we will talk about physical, mental, and sexual violence, sexism, and misogyny, and death in the course of this panel. It's possible that we might be talking about anti-Semitism and Nazi stuff at some point. That has been cut from this, but if that's part of the conversation later, we can talk about that kind of thing too. Foxes are great. Foxes get used for a lot of stuff. Historically, in literature and art, that's one strain that we might wind up talking about. So we're all here because we love foxes. Every time that we see a new fox, there's all of this cultural baggage that's embedded in them, right? We just have a whole bunch of things that we think of when we see foxes. And here's just a quick variety of all recent-y foxes. What do you think of when you hear fox?
Sneaky,
sly, cunning, sneaky. Yeah, what else?
Crafty.
Mischievous.
Crafty, mischievous, yeah, absolutely right. We just automatically assume that anytime we see a fox, oh, that's what's going to come with it. And that's true, right? We constantly reuse and recycle those ideas, and we constantly kind of reinforce those ideas, and have been doing it since the beginning, since the origins of Greek literature. We have been embedding animals with ideas and concepts, and allowing that to shape a reader's perception and the viewer's perception of things. You all know who these ones are. We all love each of these in different ways. But what we're going to do today is start by focusing on this fella, because... There we go, right? So Disney's Robin Hood, 1973. He just turned 50. Looks fantastic. I hope magic is happening to him. I hope it happens to me at some point. So we're going to start by talking about Robin, it was in the title of the panel. We're going to go a little bit backwards, right? From Renard to Robin. We're going to go from Robin to Renard in a way. This is a really cool thing. It's a really cool piece of development art. This is my most prized possession. This is a really cool thing. It is a piece of development art by the Disney Company, by an artist named Ken Anderson from the 1950s. And it is where that still that I just showed you comes from, right? Who is this?
Renard. Renard, because they wanted to do Renard at first?
It's Renard. It is Renard. Not Robin, right? But it is Robin. So this is development art for a film that Disney wound up not producing. Or rather, they wound up producing, but after a long period of development hell, of wild changes of tons of artists coming in and out. This is Renard the Fox, who you might recognize from this very size. This is another one of these like furs have always been here kind of moments. This is a mid-19th century engraving by a guy named Wilhelm von Kaulbach. It's an illustration for an edition of Goethe's Reinecke Fuchs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to mention the Disney thing that never got animated.
Don't!
Oh, that may
don't say the D word.
Get animated.
Don't.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh, so that may someday get animated.
Yeah, who knows? But they released it as a children's book. They took the concept art and released it as a. Oh, you were going to do it later. Okay, I'm sorry.
Actually, we're going to go ahead and do it now.
Okay.
like I said, Robin Hood, 1973. That's when it gets produced. Does anybody know I don't think you're allowed to participate. Does anybody know? Let's toss out some numbers. Whoever gets closest to the right answer is going to get this book. Does anybody know when Walt Disney started working on Robin Hood, or the film that would become Robin Hood?
1943? 45, 43? 63. 60. 46. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56. 56.
1937. The film that became Walt Disney's Robin Hood was in the works in 1937. For some context here, that it was in the works before Snow White came out, right? So it is there before the beginning of Walt Disney feature films in its public debut. Snow White had already been underway since 1934, so that preceded the Robin Hood film. But Disney was already working on a Renard the Fox tale in 1937, and we have some really cool notes. We have some cool documentation of the conversations in the story room about what Disney wanted to do with this film. These are quotes from Walt. Walt says, "I see some swell possibilities." Swell is a great word. Swell possibilities in Renard, but is it smart to make it? We have such a terrific kid audience, parents and kids together. That's the trouble. Too sophisticated. We'll take a nosedive doing it with animals. A lot of people don't think that's the kind of thing we should do, trying to be too smart. Right? The anxiety was, you know, this is their tales from the public domain, so Disney loves them. But there's a lot of baggage there, and it's fancy, right? Or at least American audiences don't really know who Renard is. Renard, as we're going to see, has had a long, more or less continuous tradition of engagement in among European audiences since the 12th century, running all the way through today. Europeans know Renard, in the way that maybe we know Brer Rabbit or less racist. Well, maybe not less racist. It depends. Depends on the Renard. Right, it's built in. Americans don't know this as much. There's an anxiety that it would be too fancy. Walt Disney also recognized that there was some difficulty with the Renard tales. Our main character, Renard, is a crook. He is a crook in the stories. And there's nothing about him having the Robin Hood angle. Prescient or not, I don't know. That was different because they built up these land barons and all that, but can you do that? Can you do this here? To begin with, it wouldn't be Renard. He's not to be a murderer under any circumstances. He shouldn't take advantage of anybody but a stupid individual. Walt Disney is talking with his animators, with his story people, about things that everybody already knows about Renard, or things that the story writers at least know, or things that come with Renard. He's a murderer normally, right? So we got to somehow make him not a murderer. He takes advantage of people all the time. He takes advantage of people who aren't just stupid people, but who are nice people, who are smart people, right? It's not people who quote unquote deserve it. You don't have any land barons as villains, right? There's no eat the rich angle in the Renard tales. Everybody who's the protagonist is bad. Also the difficulty that there's a lot of just absolutely visceral violence that we see in the Renard tales. So one of the most common things that we see in various incarnations of the Renard tales is this this little moment in the story where Renard pretends to be a sort of reformed sort of priestly figure, or he's a school teacher or something like that, and he does that in order to disguise himself to get close to these rabbits so that he can teach them, that is, kill them. So we can see here, here's Renard about to kill one of his rabbit pupils. So this is another another engraving by Callback, the same guy that we saw with Slinky Sexy in our earlier. He doesn't kill them because, oh, here we go. We've got the panther that comes along and notices, and then he's like, I'm just brushing your neck, it's fine. So Renard is a violent figure. There's also violence that is done to Renard or attempted to be done to Renard. One of the absolute most common things that we see in the Renard tales is Renard is put on trial at the court of King Noble the Lion. And here are two illustrations by a guy named Heinrich Kley. Heinrich Kley was absolutely fundamentally important to the development of American animation. The Disney artists adored him. He was an artist and a draftsman and published in lots of German sort of illustrated magazines. And Disney artists straight up stole his shit, just constantly stole his shit. The alligators from Fantasia, they're just more or less traced from Heinrich Kley's works. Likewise, the hippo ballerinas, like there's stuff that they just steal because it's great, because Kley is a fantastic artist. But here's an illustration of the trial of Renard at the court of King Noble. And in these illustrated, in the tale, he is almost hanged, right? The only thing that stops him from being killed is he gets to talk his way out of things and redirect violence to somebody else. So there's violence against him there. It still survives, no, right? We still have the same basic scene. So we're going to see as we go along that there are going to be lots of these little moments where you're like, I remember that from the film. That's definitely there. This is one of them, right? It's modified a little bit. This is not like a proper trial because Renard is evil. This is a sham trial, and the crown belongs to King Richard. But nevertheless, it's the same imagery that we have there. The Disney and his story folks, they worked out different ways that they might deal with these different issues of content baggage, these different issues of tone. Otto Englander, who's a really important story artist story writer for Disney, said, but it's okay. Like, yeah, he's evil, but what if we had him do all his evil stuff, but for good? What if we had him? He puts himself in different disguises all the time. What if we just redirect that against people who it's okay to do that to, right? And Disney said, yeah, you got to do it, right? Of course. And either you manage the disguise thing for good, or we're not going to touch this. Otherwise, we're going to have people on our necks. The Hayes office is down on glorifying crooks because of churches and so on. They have terrific influence. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what the Hayes office is and the church angle here. But
okay, hopefully this won't step on anything you have planned to say. Okay, I came across an article online. 15 times The Fox and Robin Hood was incredibly hot, and written by a woman, and they were all like, oh, when you could see if his tunic was so short, blah, blah, blah. And then somebody commented at the end, oh, but you left out the hottest scene, and they showed that scene of him all tied up with his collar around his neck.
There's a really great recent article in Polygon written by Josh Spiegel, who is... I think we're past the point of saying, like, don't ever talk to journalists as furries. I think we're instead at the point of know who you're talking to. Josh Spiegel is not a furry, but is pro-furry. And is a really, really nice person who specializes in writing coverage on Disney and animation stuff. And you can see there are two people in this room quoted in that article, and one of them has extremely good and smart things to say about that scene, so... so go check out the title. Something like Why Furries Love Robin Hood or something like that. excellent scene. The disguise thing, Renard constantly puts himself in different disguises. You saw him as a school teacher. One of the most common things that we see is him disguised as a penitent pseudo-priest, right? Or it's a penitent pilgrim. After he's chastised by King Noble but isn't killed, he is required through the sort of machinations of one of Noble's assistants, a character that's usually called Belin the Ram. Belin says, okay, fine, but if you really want to repent, what you should do is you need to go to the Pope in the Vatican and ask for forgiveness. And so go on a pilgrimage, and then come back, and we'll talk about everything, right? And so he goes on a pilgrimage, right? Or he starts to go on a pilgrimage, and then stuff happens to that rabbit that we'll talk about a little bit later. But he disguises himself, right? Disguise is sort of a key thing. The images of Renard disguised as a priest or a priestly figure or a pilgrim are everywhere in representation of Renard. It's probably the most common thing that you're going to see. Ivory statuette from the 16th century. We've got another callback illustration here of you know, Renard going up to the rooster. Renard preaching to the geese is a really common image that we see. And it's always malevolent, right? And you can tell. I chose these because they're really good at sort of subtle coding. That, like, this is not actual repentance where he's just like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna minister to the poor geese and it's fine. This stained glass, right? No, there's no question. That is not a repentant fox. Here you get this great sort of simultaneous narrative here. So Renard is preaching to the geese, but he has also slipped down underneath the pulpit here and is grabbing geese and killing them. So this kind of disguises there everywhere. You might have seen this is from the Smithfield Cradles, a really important illuminated manuscript, English illuminated manuscript. So again, the fox priest preaching to folks. So there's church stuff, there's murder, there's a lot of violent stuff that would be difficult. There's a lot of what we would think of as blasphemy, potentially. Most of the Renard tales contain a lot of satire and criticism of the medieval church. So the 12th century, the earliest full version of the Renard stories is an elegiac epic in Latin written by a priest named Navardus. And it's called the Isengrimus, and it's named for Renard's primary antagonist, Isengrim, who is the wolf character. And the wolf and the fox hate each other, or they constantly get each other in trouble. It gets very gruesome. At one point in the story, Renard explains to King Noble, like, oh, well, the only way to cure yourself from this cold that you have right now is you got to wrap yourself with a freshly cut wolf skin. And you got a wolf right over there. And so they seize him and they tear off his flesh and they, you know, the king is renewed. And then Isengrim regrows his skin, which is, it gets wildly cartoonish. So we got these issues. The Hays Code that Disney talks about being concerned with and being worried about, and the Hays Code's connection to the church, is an issue that a lot of Hollywood artists were dealing with in the late 20s, early 30s. So the Hays Office is named for a guy named William Hays who directed it, and it is essentially a combination of what would come to be the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA's rating system, but also it was a morality police and censorship regime that was semi under the government, but also sort of did a lot of indirect censorship. There were guides that were put out saying, here's what one should do, and studios understood what that meant was, we need to do this. This is not going to be a choice, or suddenly we're going to have markets cut off. There's a really fascinating article in 1939 issue of the magazine Look, which covers various Hollywood things, about the censorship of Hollywood that's happening in that period. And a lot of this article is talking about the things that Disney's worried about that are both like a little bit silly but also a little bit scary. Here is a scene from Schlesinger Pictures' Porky Pig and Petunia Pig. This was unacceptable. This violated the Hays Code. To have characters in a piece of film whose primary audience was children and families meant that you couldn't have any kind of clear sexuality, right? And so kissing was the wrong type of love to display. Hand-holding was okay, right? And you notice this, if you ever look back at old Mickey Mouse cartoons, old Mickey Mouse shorts, there's a lot of smooching going on until there isn't. And then suddenly it's wholesome, like hand-holding kind of stuff. So there's that. It also goes in sort of more elaborate ways. So the Hays Code had sort of ad hoc commentary on what was acceptable for nudity for funny animal characters, right? So this is Warner Brothers' character, Flossie the Cow. Flossie the Cow, this is how she was originally animated, right? What's the problem? Put yourself in the mind of a 1930s censor. What's the problem?
Udders.
My goodness, her udders are showing, right? Udders, which for cows, we don't generally think of as sexualized objects, right? They're agricultural objects, or you know, they're biological objects. The Hays Code says you can't show that on screen, right? That's the same as showing a woman's breasts on screen. And so, Flossie had to wear a skirt, right? But here's what's the problem? Flossie, 1932, Flossie wasn't good enough. What was the problem that led to 1939? Bare-chested, right? Well, she's got clothes here, which means she's naked up above, right? This is there's also some misogyny built into this, right? Nobody ever says this about Donald Duck, right? You can Donald Duck all you want, it's fine. But Flossie can't do it, right? So this is like a reverse Donald Duck, I guess. So the thing that's okay, this is one of the most hilarious kind of switches that happens, right? You go from this is too sexualized. To, well, you've made it worse. I know. Give her eyeshadow, make her fully anthropomorphic, give her a sexy, like, dress stance. Oh, done. For the children, everybody. Disney had been already grappling with this issue since the 30s. This is an early Disney. This is a screenshot from an early Disney short. It's called The Shindig. The Shindig is about all the different Mickey Mouse characters in Mickey Mouse World come together and they go to a barn party. They come and get Clarabelle Cow so they can bring her to the barn party. Clarabelle Cow. Well, there are obvious problems here, right? This short got banned in Ohio. Ohio at all in the 30s, right? Why?
It's Ohio.
No offense, Buckeyes. Why? What's wrong here?
She knows how to read. Well,
it's a reading issue. It is actually a reading issue, right? So it's not the udders, it's not the nudity, right? Well, she's got her bloomers back there, she's got her hat back there. She'll be done up eventually. The issue is that the book that she's reading is an actual novel. It's a novel by an author named Ellen Glynn called 3 Weeks, which was a sexy, sexy, sexy romance novel. It was banned in the city of Boston, the novel was. And so this was the issue, right? Censors said, you can't have Clarabelle Cow reading a book that people might know is a sexy book. Right? So no shindig for Ohio. Right? The other issue that Disney talks about in this story conference is, you know, the shindig was a big deal. They lost Ohio distribution. That's a good chunk of money. Disney can't afford to lose entire state markets. Right? And very few Disney decisions made behind the scenes in this period have anything to do with moral choice, right? They're primarily market-driven, right? So Disney as a company is in this period struggling to make it, and they need to make all the decisions that they have to make so that they can get by. Losing Ohio is a big hit. But more recently, they talk about this in that Renard the Fox story conference. They had produced this short called Who Killed Cock Robin? Who's seen this before? Okay, good. You're in for a treat. So I'm going to play it for you, and we're going to talk about why it's bad. Why the Hays Code people were furious about this thing.
Boo, boo, boo,
Was having the Haze Code people brief down next. There were lots of other people expressing complaints. And there are two primary issues with Who Killed Cop Robin. One of them is Jenny Wren. Okay, so Jenny Wren is clearly right. She's busty. She's right. She's fully clothed or something. one of the issues here is Jenny Wren is a sexualized figure here, right? This is a courtship scene, so, but that's not the real issue. The real issue is which sexualized figure Jenny Wren was. Jenny Wren was a parody of Mae West. Some of you might know Mae West, a lot of you might not. Mae West was one of the most powerful Hollywood movie stars in the history of film. In the 1930s, Mae West was making about $300,000 a year, which made her the highest paid entertainment industry professional in the world. So Mae West had an enormous amount of power. Mae West also constantly got thrown in jail. She was a playwright. She wrote lots of plays that were sort of lascivious and not lascivious. They were sexy and they were groundbreaking and they pushed some envelopes. She kept getting thrown in jail for violating obscenity laws. Mae West is, various film scholars argue that Mae West is the single reason why the Haze Code came into existence. That she was extremely sexy, she was unapologetically sexy on screen. If you want some recommendations for two great films, I'm No Angel and She Done Him Wrong are absolutely fantastic. I used to teach these films. Students were always like, what's this 1930s black and white bullshit? And then they'd go away from it and be like, holy shit, like that's amazing. They're great films. Who's the actor opposite her in She Done Him Wrong? Mae West is responsible for the introduction of one of the early Hollywood heartthrob guys, and I cannot remember who the actor is right now. It's not Clark Gable, but it's somebody of the same caliber. You probably have seen Mae West in other forms, though. Because she was omnipresent, she was extremely powerful, she gets parodied all the time. If you ever see somebody sort of doing that baby doll voice, or if you've heard, why don't you come up and see me sometime, right? That's a Mae West quote. That's a modification of a Mae West quote from I Know Angel. So you can see her in Cats Don't Dance, you can see her in lots, in various Looney Tunes kinds of things and so forth. So Mae West, this is a character, Jenny Wren, based on Mae West, is a character that is unapologetically feminist and sexual, and that got them in trouble. The other issue was that Cock Robin gets shot on screen with an arrow, and he seems to die on screen after he plummets to the ground. And so there was on-screen murder and death, right? Did he die? Who do you think shot him with an arrow?
Cupid.
There we go. Right, it's Cupid. I spoiled the 90-year-old short film. Cupid, you can tell this is not violent, but nevertheless, people were flipping out over it. So Disney's anxious about that, but they're still trying to get this to work. And one way that the Disney artists behind the scenes try to sort of work on the Renard tale and try to make it palatable is, well, if Renard isn't going to be a good protagonist, like maybe we find a good protagonist to pair him with other tales from the public domain. And what Disney winds up doing is being inspired by this Lady Chicken. This is a really important actress from the early 20th century, a woman named Maud Adams. Who you might know as being the person who performed as Peter Pan in the tour that introduced Walt Disney to Peter Pan. So Walt Disney, when he was a kid in Missouri in 1910, she came through town and she gave a performance. Later on, when Disney wanted to do an animated film version of Peter Pan, he wrote to Maude Adams and said, "Hey, would you give us our blessing for this? It would be really important to us, you know, you originated this character on stage." Maude Adams wrote back, and she's like, "No, under no circumstances. Anything that you do with this is going to be a ghost of a nothing, and I don't want any part of it." She says something, I think that's an exact word, a ghost of a nothing, or ghost is in there somewhere, and she's just like, "You can't possibly achieve what it is that I, as this actress, achieved." She also performed as a chicken. she performed in 1911 in this, you know, wildly popular play by Edmund Rostand called Chanticleer. And Chanticleer is, for those of you who have seen Rockadoodle, Don Bluth's Rockadoodle, that's the Chanticleer story. It's the story of a rooster who thinks that he causes the sun to rise, and he's all sort of puffed up about it, and then things go awry and blah, 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 right? So Disney is inspired by this. It's like, what if we take Chanticleer and we take the Renard stuff and we combine it? We make Chanticleer the hero, and we make Renard the villain, and we make it sort of like a double feature in one. So Disney acquires the rights for Rostand's Chanticleer in particular. This is not a wild idea. The Renard tales already had a version of interactions between Renard the Fox and Chanticleer the Rooster. Sometimes he's named different things. But the rooster character that appears is the same basic kind of figure. So here's Maude Adams as Peter Pan. So they tried to do this, but the one issue that Disney keeps running into is Disney is absolutely insistent that nobody likes roosters. You cannot make a rooster hero. There's a quote in one of these conversations where he says, "Yeah, but nobody's going to pick up and pet a rooster." Right? He is convinced that you cannot make a lovable rooster character. And so you have this issue that, like, well, the fox is still going to be the character people like, and he's going to be the villain in this, so what are we doing? Right? So they shelved the idea for a little while, but eventually they come back to it, and in the 40s, after 1946, when they produced Song of the South, and Disney's had some pretty good success with combination live action and animation, it saved them a ton of money, made them a fair amount of money, Disney revisited the idea of Renard the Fox and said, what if we take the Renard tales and we do with them what we did with the Br'er Rabbit tales in Song of the South, but instead put them in this story called Treasure Island, and we'll just have Long John Silver, the main character, the main sort of villain of Treasure Island, be like Uncle Remus in Song of the South and tell us little interstitial tales from the Renard tales, and we can do the same kind of thing. They try it. In the end, they wind up not being able to get it to work, and they choose instead to just make Treasure Island entirely live action. The reasons for that are also have to do with taxes. So Disney had made a deal with the UK. It was filmed in the UK. There were deals that, like, they had to funnel money back into UK productions. And, so there's some tax motivation behind that. So in the 40s, they shelved Renard again. But in the 50s, they revisit the idea. There's a Disney animator and story development artist named Ken Anderson who tries to get this to work. And he produces stuff that we have still preserved. The piece of development art I showed you at the beginning of Renard laying on the tree is one of his. He also tries to produce an animated version that's a little bit cartoonier, but it's the same basic thing that we see in the Renard tales. So here is Ken Anderson's take on the trial of Renard the Fox, right? We don't have a hangman's gallows anymore. Instead, we have a civilized courtroom. Renard is French, right? The Roman de Renard is where the story sort of becomes most popular. It gets circulated in lots of French versions. And so they just embrace it. They're like, well, that's like Renard, sort of dashing French villain, and that'll make it all okay. Anderson works up a ton of material. Anderson and another Disney development artist named Bill Pete work up a ton of material for this. Again, a lot of this has survived. Here is Renard after his capture before the trial, with people all around throwing rotten vegetables at him. Here he is in jail. You can see where this is going to go, where eventually this will become Disney's Robin Hood. All of those things are being set. But again, they just can't get it to work. And so what happens is it gets shelved again for 10 more years, and then brought back out by another Disney artist named Mark Davis. Mark Davis is more, probably more famous than any of these folks. Mark Davis produced a ton of development art for his attempt at Renard, but it's the Renard plus Chanticleer story. Okay? So you can see here, here's his sort of sly Renard. This is going to be the villain in the story. It's going to return to this idea that Disney had surfaced originally of combining Renard and Chanticleer. Renard's going to come to town and trick all of the chickens into making him mayor, and then he's going to bring all of the evil animals of the night circus to come and take things over. Again, if you've seen Rockadoodle, Bluth basically takes this as a blueprint and runs with it and makes it into Rockadoodle. Here's an opening morning chicken song that would have been in the film. Does it look familiar to anybody?
Beauty and the Beast.
This is the opening of Beauty and the Beast. This material gets recycled into lots of different places, which is a way to kind of, I'm short-circuiting where I was going there a little bit. Mark Davis's attempt at this also fails. They can't get it to work. It keeps getting shoved to the side. But later on, Disney animators will grab some of Mark Davis's work and recycle it into Beauty and the Beast. Mark Davis also got shifted out of Disney Animation and into the Disney theme parks, into working on Disneyland attractions. And this is his development art for what Renard would come to inhabit in an attraction that's no longer here today called America Sings, yeah. Which was a journey through American song. There was a gospel chicken and fox routine. right? You've got this really cute, like, wolf and the fox going with their gals to the big football match. So Davis's attempt to create this film also falls apart. And then Walt dies. And they have no idea what they're going to do, right? They've got Jungle Book to finish up, and then they're just trying to figure out, let's go back in the idea vault. Can we just pull out things really quickly? We don't have Walt's guidance, but maybe we can take some of these in-progress projects. And so they return to the idea of doing a Robin Hood story that they had played with a while ago. And eventually, Ken Anderson comes to him and says, Wolfgang Reiterman, who's in charge at the time, and says, what if we do the Robin Hood thing, but we do the fox stuff that we had developed everything for? We could just make an animal thing. And so that brings us to these moments. When Anderson was developing the art for Robin Hood, he had the work that he had done in the 50s, but he also went and found more work that was explicitly Renard material that totally informed what the characters would come to look like. And I want to show you just a couple of things. So these are illustrations from a book, and I've got a copy here if folks want to browse this later. It's a version of the Renard Tales that's illustrated by a guy named Harry Owens. This Renard is really interesting. Like, it's sort of a hip Renard for the mid-20th century. Tybalt the cat becomes sort of like gangstery. It's really cute. It's really cool illustrations. And here is an illustration of Bruin the Bear. Bruin the Bear is the Sheriff of Nottingham, right? So Ken Anderson takes Owen's work and again basically crisp. He just takes it and runs with it, uses what he had been doing, and then fleshes it more fully out with Owen's illustrations. Here you can see again moments. You know, this is a book that was not meant to be Robin Hood. It's meant to be Renard. But you can see all the character design elements that are going to go through Anderson into the final film, right? So, Robin and Skippy. It sure looks like a Robin and Skippy moment. This is again Renard pretending to try to teach Kubert the Hare, and he's going to kill him later. Oh, I spoiled it. We'll see that. And then, like I said, come feel free at the end of the panel to come and browse through this. But you can see stuff Anderson just takes wholesale from this. Right? When they're doing it, then they finally decide, okay, we can make this Robin Hood thing work, and this is the end of the story of getting Renard the Fox to come to film, right? Or is it .. If you want to learn more about that, I'll tell you more about that later. But that's where we're going to stop for Robin for now, because I want to talk about some other instances of Renard. So before, or while Disney was trying to work out the Renard stories in the 30s, to see what they could do. About 3 months before Disney's Snow White premiered in theaters, a stop-motion animation of the story of Renard was produced by Irène and Ladislas Starovich. And a French version that I think is absolutely charming. You can also see elements of stuff that Disney probably saw and borrowed.
Les vaches la racontent le soir dans leurs étables à leurs petits veaux. Les lapins la disent dans leurs clairières. Les écureuils dans leurs branches. Les animaux sauvages dans leurs déserts.
So in case you can't see the subtitles in the back, the monkey professor says, "Hey, I'm going to tell you one of the oldest stories in the animal kingdom. All of the animals tell it to their kids all the time as bedtime stories and so forth." Oh no, you didn't see that.
Et voici d'abord quelques-uns des héros de notre histoire. Maître Corbeau, auquel Monsieur de La Fontaine en personne a bien voulu s'intéresser. Les seigneurs de la basse-cour, Messire Lecoq et sa grande épouse si méritante, Dame la Poule. Poltron, le lièvre, le pauvre petit lièvre, toujours traqué, toujours craintif, le cœur battant, l'oreille battante. Renaud et Cerbère, les deux adjudants de la ferme.
It's the 30s, folks. Master Badger, the lawyer. Same stories are being adapted. So it's a sort of rush. There's an arms race in the market to get stuff out. So I want to talk a little bit now about some of the background behind the Renard tales, stuff that informs stuff that informs how we come to understand the Renard tales and where we get these foxy ideas from. And we're going to start with Aesop. Because all things begin with Aesop when we're talking about funny animal and funny stuff. So Aesop isn't real, he can't hurt you. Aesop is a fictional legendary guy that is said to have lived around the 6th century BCE in Greece. And the Greeks attribute to him the development of the idea of animal stories. And he is, the character is said to be an enslaved person who uses just his wits to get him through life, to gain his freedom. He also just kind of sticks it to people constantly. And he says that he uses these animal stories both because they are the sort of primordial knowledge that we had. All of these stories come back from a time when humans and animals spoke the same language before we were sundered from one another. But Aesop also says, like, I'm using these stories because I'm not actually talking about you, jerkface. I'm just talking about a rooster. If you see yourself in this rooster, that's your problem, right? So it's a way for people who are enslaved, people who are less powerful, to be able to critique and comment on people who have more power from them, but to do it with sort of plausible deniability, right? So here is his Fitzhundred Vaz representing Aesop conversing with a fox, right? The fox is giving his wisdom to Aesop. Aesop is always represented as being sort of physically grotesque. There is only one surviving biography of an enslaved person from the ancient world, and it is the biography of Aesop, or what we come to call the Aesop romance. It's a second century CE work, probably, that tells us the adventure of Aesop. So that's the one enslaved person's biography that we get. He's not even real. In Aesop's tales, the fox reappears all the time. And the fox has all of the sort of characteristics that we come to expect from foxes in literature. So there is a fable of the fox and the theater mask, where a fox walks up to some, you know, theatrical props that are just sitting around. He sees a mask and he says, "Oh, mask, you know, you look so good. Too bad you got no brains in you, right? You're just stupid. You look nice, but you're stupid." Right? So it's a way for the fox to demonstrate his cleverness. He can see through the appearances of beauty. He can see through the appearances of excellence and know what's deep down true. The idea of the fox looking at a mask or of looking at a fox, that's a thing that we see variously in later reception. Here's a really cool cover for Charles Bennett's famous Aesop, showing a person looking in a mirror and seeing a fox, right? It's like Thurston Howell's, what's the book called? Furries Among Us, yeah, right? It's got a person looking in a mirror and there's a wolf. It's the same basic thing. So again, furries always here. So foxes are clever, but foxes are also mischievous and malevolent or self-serving. Right? Self-serving more often than malevolent. For those of you who were at AC last year, you might remember that Aesop's Fables was the theme. Sue the Deer, is Sue here? I don't think Sue managed to make it. Sue did the art for the badge and shirt and various other things. Here is exactly that story that we just saw in the opening of the Roman de Renard by French people. But here we have an adaptation, right, of a very Pittsburgh-y fox and the crow, fox with the pigeon dropping a pierogi. Again, the same like buttering up a pigeon/crow to say, "Oh, I bet you have a beautiful scene." But foxes are also often represented as being sort of outsiders. They're not part of the sort of reputable animals. They're not part of the inner circle of the court of animals. So when we see the royalty of the animal kingdom represented in fable, right, lions are always in charge. And there are always bears and deer and what other around them, and the foxes are not part of that. Some of that is just this sort of inherent fable take on foxes as being not only sort of, you know, deceptive, but dangerous, right? You want to keep them at arm's length because they're going to lie to you anytime they can, or they're going to lie to you to either get something that they need or just to make themselves feel better. So the story of the fox without a tail, we all know this, right? A fox who loses his tail goes and tries to convince all the other foxes, "Hey, you know what's really cool? Not having a tail. Everybody should cut them off right now. Join the club," right? And all the other foxes are like, "No, you're an idiot. You look gross. Everybody should have a tail," right? Everybody should have a tail is the moral of the story. You might remember that this gets adapted in another modern telling of foxes, right? The loss of the fox's tail and the anxiety of losing the tail It's the same basic element from Aesop being adapted and put into Fantastic Mr. Fox. So. While these are basic blueprints, a lot of different authors, both in antiquity and today, take the ideas that we have of the fox and they try to play with them because they're so strongly embedded that inverting them or pushing against them gives you a ton of opportunity for really cool play with expectations. So I want to show you a really cool moment from my childhood. So this is a clip from a Rocky and Bullwinkle short inside Rocky and Bullwinkle. And it's a clip from Aesop and Son short, which are like fractured fairy tales, but it's the Aesop stuff instead. So here we go.
A fox invited a stork to have dinner. Have you ever had a stork for dinner? That is, I mean, invite a stork to have dinner with you? We foxes, you know, have the reputation of being cunning, crafty, sly, and foxy. Actually, what I really am is a soft little furry beast who wants nothing more than to be a respected member of the community.
All right! Aren't we all looking for that?
More than to be a respected member of the community. PTA, Little League Baseball, that sort of thing. And I'm starting out by inviting that pillar of community living, Mr. Stork.
This must be the place.
That's right.
Because it has a crafty look.
Now, just a minute there.
A cunning, crafty, foxy look about it. You must be Mr. Fox.
Well, that's a fine way to talk. I mean, here I go to all the trouble to fix dinner.
All right, where do you hide them?
Hide them?
The bodies, the chicken bodies.
Oh,
we gotta be too careful who we get in the community. Chicken pot pie.
Chicken pot pie? That's not chicken.
I'm on to you, Mr. Fox, and your chicken picking ways. Good night.
Now, how could he mistake split pea soup for chicken pot pie?
He just had to be accepted into Mr. Stork's community.
If I could just convince Mr. Stork that I'm not the sly, crafty, chicken stealer type he thinks I am.
Just as I thought, chicken snatcher.
This chicken just came and sat down on the bench with me.
Listen, chicken snatcher. Who ever heard of a chicken sitting on a bench with a fox?
But why can't I be accepted? Why? Why? And again, why?
Why? Why? And again, why?
I'll tell you again why. It's because you keep following me around, that's why. What do you want from me, chicken? Why do you keep following me around?
Because I want to be accepted by the community, too.
Well, butt off. I can't be seen with you. People get the wrong impression. Whoops. Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Stork.
Chicken snatcher.
Oh, Mr. Stork, I can explain. You see...
Forget about it, Mr. Fox. Come over and have dinner with me tonight.
All right, chicken. I accept your invitation. It really is too bad I'm not accepted by Mr. Stork. But you see, I've quite a bit of money I'd like to use for improvement of his community.
Chickens.
Dum 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 dum. Oh, why, Mr. Stork, this is a surprise.
Mr. Fox, I come over to invite you to dinner this evening. You will be there promptly at 8:30 sharp.
Oh, Mr. Stork, thank you, thank you. Whoops. Oh, I'm terribly sorry, but I've already made a previous engagement with Chicken.
Chicken? Possibly you've misunderstood me. I am a stork. I'll be there at 8:30 sharp, and I'll pretend I didn't hear what you said.
Invited to dinner by Mr. Stork. Oh, I finally made it. Chicken will understand. After all, this is my big chance, and he's just a chicken.
So, Mr. Fox arrived promptly at 8:30.
Now, Mr. Fox, I understand you have some money. You wish to invest in our community? Delicious. You'll find we storks are very particular just who we let in our community. We have certain standards, traditions, and manners. Enjoying your dinner, Mr. Fox?
Well, for a jar, I'd say it was very tasty. But now, if you'll excuse me, I must run, but you see, I'm starving. Chicken, it's your good friend, Mr. Fox. Am I too late for dinner?
Good evening, Mr. Fox. You know, somehow I had the feeling that you had stood me up to have dinner with Mr. Stork.
Oh, that'd be a foxy thing to do.
So, Mr. Mr. Fox had a wonderful dinner at Chicken's house, and afterwards he became a respected member of the community, the chicken community. And Mr. Fox used most of his money for improvements of the chicken community, Little League baseball, community centers, that sort of thing. For after his dinner with Mr. Stark, he had learned one thing, which is the moral of this story. Do you know what that is, Junior?
If a chicken invites you to dinner, accept. For he may grow to be 30 feet tall.
Nah, Junior, there you go again.
I love
him.
It's a great So here we can see a version of these Aesopic fox tales, but flipped on their heads, right? That's the sort of nature of this kind of fractured fairy tale take. Moral of the story is a little bit questionable, right? I think that the answer is that Fox should probably have been taxed at a higher rate. Shouldn't have to depend on Fox's money for public infrastructure. But nevertheless, so I want to talk about a couple of other places where the idea of Foxes, the idea in particular of the Renard that we started with, likewise gets sort of adapted for different uses. I want to start with cookies. Alas, I can't hand out cookies today. AC rules, blah, blah, blah. Have we all had a Purelene or Pepperidge Farms Pirouettes before?
Woo!
Yeah, cookies! Purelenes were invented by a Belgian bakery, where they claimed to be the first people to have invented these rolled wafer cookies. And this Belgian bakery is called De Buchler, and they had a whole Renard marketing campaign. There's a really interesting full retelling of the Renard tales in full newspaper sheets, in these little clips, that have both illustrations, these lovely illustrations, but also have a text that explain what it is that you're supposed to be seeing. And here we have another really common instance of, a really common moment in the Renard tales that we're going to see some other versions of. And this is the moment where Renard is approached by his good friend, Grimbart the Badger. Grimbart the Badger, who serves primarily as Renard's advocate in court with King Noble Life. Again, Badger lawyer. I don't know what it is about Badger lawyer. And Grimbart tries his best, but he's got a shitty client that can't shut his mouth. One thing that Grimbart tries to do is pulls Renard aside and says, "Okay, I will represent you. I will try to help you out, but you must repent and you must promise to stop murdering people, because I can't help you if you just keep murdering people and just murdering people in front of people. So just repent, just apologize, right?" And so this is Grimbart the Badger listening to Renard's confession, really common moment in the Renard tales. What Renard is confessing in this cookie advertisement is that in all of his life, he has never had a cookie as delicious as these cookies. Really just selling it there, Renard. It's a really hilarious moment. Like, in the originals, right, he's just, in the Ys and Grimace, in his confession, Renard gets really worked up and excited as he recounts all of the stuff that he has done. He's like, "Yeah, I murdered that person, and it was bad, but it was really good. And then I murdered this person, I ate them, it tasted really good, but it was probably bad, but oh god, it's so good," right? He's just like almost frothing the mouth with excitement, reliving his crimes, right? And the idea that he's like, you know, I've tasted every sin imaginable, but no sin is as good as the Brickler's cookies. This is not the only advertiser that uses Renard. Once upon a time, various companies would release these little trading cards, basically. And you got to catch them all. You can collect them all. They'll have illustrations of various things. Sometimes they'll be scenes from classical mythology, or retelling of the Iliad, or retelling of other famous literature. And one of the Empire Ringer Company of Auburn, New York, takes bits of the Renard tale to sell their laundry ringers. And the one tie to this is showing Renard wringing the neck of Cooper the Hare, right? In front of Renard's wife and her kids. This is a family piece of equipment, right? If you want a good, you know, clean pressed napkins to feed your neighbors than Empire Ringer is the one for you. Repentance of Renard, this murdering of Cooper at the Hare, this needing to go on a pilgrimage, this gets, like I said, represented again and again. And you can see lots of different illustrators over time have really different takes on what it is that's going on in Renard's head. So here is an absolutely beautiful one. So Fedor Flinzer illustrated both the Renard tales, but also there's a wild piece of ancient literature called The Battle of the Frogs and Mice. The title in Greek is Batrakomuomakia. Batrakomuomakia. There we go. Thank you very much. Literally just translates to The Battle of the Frogs and Mice. And he illustrated that, and it's just like this hyper romantic, heroic mice fighting against these frogs, and it's very goofy. But he illustrated Renard. And here is the hare and the ram accompanying Renard on his pilgrimage. And Renard, he looks sad, right? He's sorry for what he did. I'm sorry about all the people I killed. I'll go and see the Pope and it'll be fine. This is the top of that page, and this is the bottom of that page, showing Renard murdering that rabbit that we just saw, right? To feed his family, right? But nevertheless, murder. So we have Flinzer. Flinzer does that. Christian Pollard did this great version that is, again, Renard trying to give his confessions to Grimbar the Badger and trying to repent through that. I just love this one because you can tell that Grimbar's just like, I don't believe anything that you're saying. I don't know why we're doing this, but nevertheless, right? He's doing his revenge. A more modern version by Fritz Eichenberg sort of plays with that idea and suggests the idea that Renard's actually struggling internally, and he's struggling against foxness in this. So here we have Renard confessing to Grimbard, and here we have Renard going off on his pilgrimage. And the cool details that I think you can see here that Eichenberg works in is, as he's going off on his pilgrimage, he's got a little angel fox accompanying him, right? It seems to be good intentions here, or holy intentions. Down here, you can see his angel fox is fighting with demons, right? Inside you are three foxes, two demons, and an angel. Do what you can with that, right? The weeping, the weeping and the angels kind of whatever it is. A lot of these depictions are religious in nature. They, you know, again, because that's kind of built in that he's going on a pilgrimage, and he's seeking forgiveness through his confession. But some artists will take the religious elements out and make a-religious versions of this. Here's a great version by Paul Osterhoff, Dutch version, showing Grimbard the Badger granting absolution to Renard, right? But by laying him over his knee and just whipping him with a rod. This doesn't awaken anything. Okay, I want to show just a couple more things. So here's another really interesting artist. A lot of these artists that I've shown you are Dutch or German, and the Dutch and the German and the French are the best at making Renard come alive and just have this continuous tradition that they're playing with. Here's another German artist who was born Karl Ernst Fischer, but he went by a pen name Sif Fischer, and Sif Fischer is probably most famous in Europe for being the illustrator of this comic strip that was in weekly newspapers, in the Frankfurt Illustrated, and elsewhere. Oscar, Der Familienvater, right? Oscar, the family man cat. And the Oscar comics are all about, you know, this cat Oscar who's got kids and a wife, and he just wants to go and have fun, but he's got a family he's got to take care of too, and so it's the push and pull of, you know, doing what you need to do, but wanting to also have a life and an identity beyond family. You can see a picture of Sif Fischer over here on the right with one of his cats. You might notice that he's illustrating in an unusual way. He is using his mouth to paint. The reason he's doing that is in 1944, right near Frankfurt, the train station of Fulda was bombed by Allies during World War II while Fischer was riding the train. And he lost both of his arms. He had, before the war started, been a draftsman, had been an artist. He lost his arms in the war. He was, I believe that he was, in fact, a member of the Nazi Party, but in the, I live in Germany and I'm not a combatant and I don't want to die kind of way. You know, like, I'm not going to say anything, but I'm not going to do anything pro-Nazi either. I think that's true. I can't actually confirm fully yet what his party affiliation was. But nevertheless, right, when Fuller is bombed, when he loses his arms, he says, I'm not going to give up being an artist. I've trained to be an artist all my life. I'm just going to figure out how to do it now the way that I've got to do it. The reason I want to show you Sir Fischer is both he's a really interesting character, but he's also he was a phenomenal artist, both as a comics artist, but also made a version of Renard Fox in 1947. Right, 3 years after losing his arms, he goes and illustrates a Renard the Fox tale. And here are some bits of it. Right, so you can see this is the front cover of Renard sort of being dashing. He's got his medal. How did he get that medal? Well, in the end, he tricks the king and queen noble into giving him a medal and making him, you know, being like Renard. He gets land. Right, he becomes a landed baron. Right, but through trickery, he looks a little bit funky right here, right? So, right, beautiful orange coat, less orange coat. The reason is one of the, again, sort of standard parts of the Renard tales is he has to fight Isengrim the Wolf. And the way that he devises to defeat Isengrim the Wolf, he goes and talks with Grimbar the Badger and talks with this monkey woman, and they say, you know what you need to do? You need to be really slippery. Because then you won't be able to hold on. So we're going to shave you and we're going to oil you up. Grimbard is way into this. I can't tell if it's just like, this is amazing, right? Or it's like, this is what you get. I put up with this shit. I've been your lawyer 800 times. You can't shut your mouth like, I'm shaving you and oiling you up. So let me show you just a clip showing Sir Fischer at his work.
Man spricht von C. Fischer, nicht nur in Deutschland, jetzt auch in Amerika. Vor kurzem wurde er als erster Deutscher von der USA-Gesellschaft der Katzenfreunde mit einer Ehrenurkunde ausgezeichnet.
So he goes to Frankfurt Zoo to go and get inspiration and a model for his newest comic, is basically what that says.
Im Frankfurter Zoo studiert er seine Modelle, denn C. Fischer ist ein Meister des Zeichenstiftes. Im Krieg hat er beide Arme verloren, aber zwei Dinge hat C. Fischer behalten, den Lebensmut und das Talent. Schon auf dem Höhepunkt seiner Laufbahn fing er nochmals von vorne an. Und jetzt sieht es beinahe so aus, als brauchte man nur die Zähne zusammenzubeißen, um über den Verlust hinwegzukommen. Der Pinsel gehorcht genauso wie früher. C. Fischers Lieblingstier ist der Kater Oskar, dem er durch den Zeichenstift inzwischen zum Weltruhm verholfen hat. Woche für Woche bereitet er Hunderttausenden Freude und Vergnügen.
So, okay, we're going to jump forward to the end. A really interesting illustrator. There are lots and lots of other illustrators. I want to jump forward a little bit and leave you with something just bizarre. Just a bizarre, fun, modern version of the Renard tales. And this is an extremely 80s. So this is an animated, a French animated series called Moi Renard. Renard. It's a story of Renard the Fox moving to Paris, moving to the big city, and he establishes an agency where he promises to do whatever job you need, get it done, and to be whatever you need him to be, right? So he's just a fox of all trades, and every episode is an adventure where he just is caught up and like, oh, you need a vampire hunter? Shit, you're not. So let me just leave you with this last little bit, the opening. There is a Dutch film that is based on a Dutch novel written by a guy named Connection. In that story, it's a Renard story, but it's a Renard story in which Renard represents like good European stock. And what happens that causes trouble in the community is these rhinoceroses move in. These rhinoceroses who are not from Europe. They're foreigners, and they got these big rhinoceros noses, and they come in and try to take everybody's money. And Renard figures out a way to drive them into the sea, where they all die, and their ghosts rise up as all of the people are watching a sunset. So there's a 30s, 40s version of allegorizing with race and ethnicity through these tales, for sure. I think that a lot of artists and writers do sometimes see species as like, this is a great tool for telling lots of stories and for being allegory for this or that, right? And something that I talk a little bit about with my students when we watch Zootopia, right? I mean, we don't have to hammer on too much about this, but right, Zootopia's racial narrative is muddy at best, an issue that you'll always run up against. I mean, this is something that actually is maybe more thoughtfully applied in the Dutch Nazi version. Never a good sentence. Right? But one of the problems is all of the different species start interacting with one another, and there aren't species lines that are being maintained to keep the species pure. And that's an effect of these rhinoceroses coming in. And returning, strong divisions between species is a sort of key takeaway of that film. There are any number, right? Once you introduce species as a metaphor for race, you have issues of, you have issues of race no longer being a construct, right? Species is not a construct in a way that race is a construct. And you start diving into these issues of like anti-miscegenation laws and, invariably, my students talk at one point or another when we're doing things about the the Zootopia comic. You know which one I'm talking about. Right? And they're like, you know, what happens in an anthropomorphic world where, like, I mean, is the world of Zootopia inherently, like, no, you can't marry a rabbit if you're a fox because you can't have kids, or there's going to be biological differences or whatever, right? So it gets super messy. And it is a thing that, like, people dip into for good, for bad and good intentions. So, yeah, I don't know if that answered.
Yeah,
you might, I'll let
a few last questions.
Okay, sure, yeah, we can chat more later, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Three quick examples of foxes as con artists and so on. 1960, Calvin and the Colonel. It was basically Amos and Andy with a fox and a bear, mm-hmm. and was produced by the folks that gave us the Munsters and Leave It to Beaver, believe it or not. So that was Calvin and the Colonel. You can see it on YouTube and everything. Also, you had some commercials for Schwäbisch Hall from Germany. You know, here's the smart way to invest. He's a fox and things like that. And then, like I say, I'm just trying to think about the third example. There was, oh boy, it just popped out of my head. But this, yeah, of course, we talked about Nick Wilde and things like that. There's all sorts of examples of that sort. I just remembered. Yeah, Fibber Fox. Okay, the cartoons with Yaki Doodle. He was always trying to get, you know, Yaki Doodle.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yep.
that was an archetypal character of a fox. And there have been other characters as well, of course. And we've had Zootopia. But the thing is, you had not just a smart and wily fox in Nick, but you also had someone who may not have been so smart. Gideon, although he does learn how to be a cook, and he kind of reforms himself.
Yeah,
so,
it
does go into the whole thing about stereotypes, and can you, you know, oh, you can't make a fox into a cop. Well, maybe you can, you know.
And you know, Nick's like, I only became what I
right.
was because that was what people made me, that was what everybody was, thought I was.
I might as well, you know, hey.
Right? Yeah. So yeah, the idea of like species
predestination.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Predestined to be a crook.
Yeah. There's another good. I mean, I think Robin toes this line a little bit. Of on the one hand, he's a crook. Right? He's a good. He's stealing from the right people and giving to the right people. The old speckled hen fox is, I think.
Oh yeah, the
another like that, heir,
that, British ale. Yeah.
Like, you know,
he's debonair and
debonair upright. And right. So he's not a thief, but he's like, he's the parts of like, you know, Thomas Crown. That are not the steely parts, but the suave parts. We love this archetype and to play with it too. So, yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little about my memory of the Robin Hood film. There's that rooster bard. Is there a link between that and the Shankar character in that development? Do you see that in like terms of part of the development art that turned into the rooster bard?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, Chanticleer, the thing that sort of is the most characteristic element of Chanticleer in Renard Tales is he is a singer and he's sort of proud of himself and whatever. So the idea of rooster as singer, right? And you can see there's some obvious like, oh, roosters sing, like they make noises. So the development. If you wanna look at some really cool development art, a lot of Ken Anderson stuff is. Preserved and published in Didier Guez's They Drew As They Pleased, Volume 5, which is the Renaissance years. And it's just, it's all the Robin Hood stuff that he had done. It's stuff for Catfish Bend, which is a children's series that also, like, they tried to reuse a bunch of Anderson stuff for. It got put into Rescue. All of the down home Creole animals were in that, and that was an attempt to keep the rooster bard. So the rooster bard is already there. He's got big pantaloons in the story too. So yeah, check it. It's a great book. It's just like a beautiful coffee. You just like want to eat it. It's just so good. Any other questions or thoughts? Yeah.
Sorry, you brought up Nazis.
Sorry, I'm really sorry.
Sorry, sorry. Maps. Is there any context you want to put that in with animals being used in these other ways?
Yeah, I think that's another really good example of racialization, right? So Mouse using cats and mice as shorthand for talking about, right, oppression, for talking about genocide, I think that that's drawing from the same well. And I mean, doing it much more carefully and also much less anti-Semitically, because it's not by Nazis. Right?
Archspiegelman.
Experienced it, yeah. You had a question, yeah.
I was going to ask if any of this would be posted online after class.
Good question. So I will not post it because there are copyright stuff that I can't do. But I hear tell that Anthrocoon.
You're all caught.
Has stuff. And we'll
it's not video. It's strictly audio. Don't worry. Your pictures will not be on this.
Okay, so
I am going to post it. There will be links on Twitter and on the Anthrocon Discord. I'm going to upload it tonight, hopefully.
Cool.
So later on, Anthrocon, the general channel on Discord.
Do you want to share your Twitter handle for folks?
Radio Raccoon.
Radio Raccoon.
And then Anthrocon for everything else. But yeah, Radio Raccoon for Twitter.
So some of them will be. Feel free to reach out anytime. I'm delighted to chat with folks. You can find me on Twitter really easily at cbpolt. You can also shoot me an email, polt@bc.edu. Happy to chat. Again, this is just a small chunk of things, and we can only cover a little bit. So any questions at all, feel free, and I'm happy to point you in the direction of cool things to read or other art to look at or other artists to play with. So. And check out some of these. Check out some of the animated things that I gave you clips of. The Starovich Rondavan art is great. It's just it's amazingly smooth, but also clunky, depending on what scene you're in. It's really cool stuff. So. Yeah. Well, thank you again so much. Have a wonderful rest of your time.
All right. Thank you.
If anybody wants to take a quick browse at the Owen's book, feel free.